Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to, as a matter of fact, I need to remind you that the information for a prayer circle, and you, if you have a prayer circle, if you want to lead in your own local area, because it's good to be able to actually have in-person, you know, prayer circles, and being able to have more of that intimacy. But we have a national prayer circle where we actually have people from, you know, different states dialing in and so forth that, you know, come together at a specific time to pray for, you know, his hand in blessing us in taking back this government on the Constitution, or getting this government to basically get back into the framework of the Constitution. Folks, if we do that, we're not, you know, I mean, don't buy into these cockamamie plans of, you know, oh, we're going to give you this, we're doing this. You know, we didn't like it when they did Obama phones. And as a matter of fact, welcome back, Sean, because we're not going through the Constitution. I'm sorry, we're not going through the Constitution content anymore because that just ended yesterday. Now, Sean, you didn't know that I actually did a special. You probably didn't listen to my show on Monday, did you? Which is okay. It's okay. It's okay. I know that, you know, we're all busy. And it was a show based on the Marine Corps birthday. And so, you know, so on Veterans Day, we actually aired the final amendments to the Constitution. So we wrapped up the Constitution. So we're ready to cover new content. And so on Monday, I decided, you know what? This has always been bugging me. And so now that I've actually done the due diligence, I've actually gone through the documents. What is the legitimate first service ever formed by Continental Congress? Legitimately formed by Continental Congress. Now, the Army argues that they were formed in June 1775 by Continental Congress, right? Because you're prior Army, I'm just basically making...
Yes, sir.
Okay, so, all right. So if that's the case, then Continental Congress, under the Articles of Association, would have that authority to do that because the states had delegated that authority to form an army. But they didn't actually have that authority. We're going to go through, we already covered this earlier this year, at the beginning of the year, but next year we're going to cover the Articles of Association so that we can see what authority Continental Congress had. Now, I think it's really important to kind of re-review, because it's been that long. Where are we? Because this new government is just being stood up. This concept of a bank is what we're going to be covering today. And so I want to get this into the lead, but I'm using this little sibling rivalry between the services to really lay out what Continental Congress had the ability to do and what they did on paper were two different things. In other words, they did some things on paper that they just didn't have the authority and they couldn't do it. In other words, when they created the Continental Army, what they really had was George Washington in charge of the Boston Militia, or I should say the Massachusetts Militia, and they convinced other states to send reinforcements from their militia to work with Washington, and that basically Continental Congress was asking for everybody to kind of comply with Washington to repel this invasion into Massachusetts. This is in 1775. So when Continental Congress basically claimed that they had formed the Continental Army, they had no authority to do that, nor did they have the money to do that either. They couldn't even fund Continental Congress or Continental Army. And what ended up happening in October was they basically said, okay, we need warships. Because clearly the British have warships with these galleys of guns that, you know, are decimating our fishery ships. We need to be able to do something out on the water to stop Britain before they get to us. So this was the whole intent, and this is one of the reasons why this was forefront in most of the framers' minds, that we needed a navy to strategically protect us so that nobody could get to us. Now, got to remember, this is back in, you know, the 1700s when they didn't have radar. They didn't have tracking and the ability. So for a ship to find another ship in the open ocean, how hard do you think that would be? Very difficult, folks.
Pretty tough.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like we got, you know, satellites and all this type of, you know, collection capabilities to find out where transmissions, you know, these electronic signatures. I mean, if you understand what I'm talking about, these were the hard days. So they needed, and what John Adams absolutely did in his presidency, which was the right thing to do, was to create a part of the Navy, which was the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard would be small little ships that would basically be out there, you know, just out off the shore to basically create the, you know, the, hey, they're coming, or we've got a ship here. And the smaller ship would basically, you know, come in, and the bigger ships would go out to defend us. John Adams really wanted a very elaborate navy to protect us. He couldn't get the funding, though, and he had the same problem that they did with Continental Congress in 1775. So Continental Congress said, well, we can't order a navy, and so we're going to order two ships. And so they ordered two ships to actually be formed, and those ships, they couldn't even pay for those. In other words, these ships were going to be on contract to be built with galleys and all of this other stuff so that they could conduct war instead of fishing and cargo and so forth. So what they ended up doing was they ended up getting this sailor, and I forget what state he was from. Now, technically, if you do the research, you'll find that Rhode Island actually was one of the first states to have a navy, but they didn't volunteer the navy for the Continental Congress to control or to have an admiral and a Continental Navy. They weren't on board with supporting it that way. They were on board with giving some requisitions to Washington, but that still didn't form the army, if you know what I'm saying. So technically, it did not legitimately form the army because all the states were still holding back. It wasn't until the Articles of Confederation where they actually had the ability to form and pay for and fund with requisitions to the states, as long as the states were willing to pay those requisitions. This all kind of leads into today's content, because what we ended up getting after the Constitution was ratified, where there were several states that still hadn't paid that war debt that Continental Congress, with the Articles of Confederation, was able to do. Prior to that, under the Articles of Association, they didn't even have the ability to take on debt. So on November 10th, George Washington and a little cadre of members of Congress went to Tun Tavern, just down the street, and said, we need to recruit Marines so that we can get them on these fishing ships that are going to be volunteered, or basically these captains of their fishing ships are going to take these Marines aboard, and these fishing ships are going to lure the British fleet close to them so that we can steal their ships and create a navy, which was the beginning of acquiring ships for the U.S. Navy. Before they could actually establish a navy, they had to have the ships, and then they could create, because these, you know, they didn't even have a commander or a commodore, or, you know what I'm saying, an admiral to you know, basically lead. So when you really look at how everything was happening, the divine hand of providence, people, you know, they say, you know, what a blessing it was. Folks, you have no idea how our Creator and how He, you know, supplicated us with His love and these benefits, or I should say these blessings in helping this chaotic situation actually move forward so that we would have an semblance of any chance of beating Britain. Most people know about the getaway in New York because of the fog. If you're familiar with McCullough, I think his name is David McCullough, who wrote, you know, 1776. He also wrote John Adams and so forth. But he tells the story how George Washington in Back Bay in Massachusetts in 1775 slipped away with that Continental Army because the British had had him trapped on this little piece of land, and it was a bunch of boats that, under the fog, under the guise of heavy fog, Washington got away. And he got away again in New York. And those types of things, when you really look at, you know, how everything was laid out, how Britain had us cornered, and we were literally going to, it was just going to be over with. They were going to, you know, kill, once they killed Washington, that was going to be it, if you understand how important that man was. Because he was the leader of the resistance. There were people, Benedict Arnold, by the way. Do you know the story about Benedict Arnold?
No, I do not know the specific story. I've always been curious about
Okay, so let's cover that real quick, too, because it's fascinating. Benedict Arnold was literally, he was on the heels of Washington in his army career with the British Army, and or the British forces that were running the Indian Wars and so forth, where Washington, and the reason why Washington decided, he was very reluctant in siding with, you know, fighting in the revolution, because he felt he was that close to getting his generalship. And when he was denied in, you know, one of the years just before, I think it was like 1773, something like that, when he was denied his commission as a general, that really just got under his skin. And so he was possessed with this fact that he deserved that commission. He was going to be the first American with a general, you know, rank. And he felt he deserved it. And I believe he did, but he had a Washington underneath him, and that Washington was Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold, actually, if you look at Benedict Arnold's career, it was just exemplar, just like Washington's. And Benedict Arnold was supposed to get, and should have gotten, he felt that based on his valor and his victories and everything else, that he deserved that second in command underneath Washington. And that went to, instead of Benedict Arnold, it went to Ethan Allen, who had far less time and far less, you know, credentials than Benedict Arnold. There was something about Benedict Arnold that Washington didn't like because he thought he was too ambitious, what have you. And so, regardless of, you know, the personality problem, Washington created a problem by doing the exact same thing to him that Britain did, doing this exact same thing to Benedict Arnold that Britain did to him, is what I'm trying to say. So, not even knowing, but I'm telling you, Benedict Arnold put that, you know, it was just this really bitter pill that he had to take, that he had to continue working, and over time, it bothered him and bothered him and bothered him to the point where he finally said, that's it. I have no loyalty to that man or to this cause. And he went to the side of Britain and actually started, you know, basically providing intelligence and so forth. And it was when Washington and Hamilton went to meet with Benedict Arnold at his home, he was gone. And Benedict Arnold had no idea that Washington was there looking for him, because they were looking for the spy that was basically giving away, you know, their intelligence. And but they didn't think it was him. They just knew that it was, you know, somewhere under his command, somebody that had enough information to basically help Britain. And so they were there, and his wife was, she actually played. So if you, Ron Chernow writes the Alexander Hamilton biography, and I believe it's in Alexander Hamilton's biography where they kind of talk about this situation where Benedict Arnold's wife was entertaining both him and Washington. And the way she was behaving, she was like, she was feverish and started kind of quasi-disrobing. And both Washington and Hamilton, they didn't leave.
And both accounts, both the Washington biography and Ron Chernow's biography, kind of, you know, affirm the fact that they stayed there watching, well, what's going to happen next, kind of thing. And they were going home. And Washington actually was thinking, and he wrote in his diaries, he was thinking that maybe she was, you know, going this way because that, you know, Benedict Arnold was one of those guys that liked to see his wife in those types of circumstances. Anyway, I don't want to divulge, you know, go too far into the gutter here. But the point is these guys just stuck around until finally Washington goes, man, we've been here a long time waiting and nothing has happened. And, you know, and nothing has progressed any further in the disrobing department. So he said, well, we need to get going. So they actually left. And unbeknownst to them, there was a sentry that actually questioned Benedict Arnold, who was a real junior person that didn't know who Benedict Arnold was. And they searched him, and they found the intelligence in his boots. That's when they actually caught him. But while and Washington and Hamilton basically were, you know, they were like a half a day late or hours late from Benedict Arnold basically fleeing and never going home and then meeting up with the British and then becoming employed with the British at that point. So that's kind of that story. But Benedict Arnold was a very valiant warrior for the cause. And it was just like Washington. He didn't get what he deserved and he felt that he was betrayed. And that's why he did what he did. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, Washington, you know, had, you know, these paradigms. I mean, he was a great man, but he wasn't perfect, obviously. And he kind of created a condition where he should have fixed that problem. And I think Arnold basically brought it to him. Are you kidding me? You know, he challenged him on it, and Washington didn't like that either. So these are kind of shortcomings of, you know, typical leaders. You don't challenge. Did you know that Washington had no reservation of shooting his own men in the back if they ran from their positions on the battlefield? That's the rule. I mean, and he did that. But in his own slaves.
That's the rule.
and in his diary, though, when his slaves ran away from him, you know, he pleaded, he went after them to bring them home so he could take care of them. He wouldn't think about shooting them in the back for deserting him. Does that make sense? It's a huge conflict of where, you know, Washington was really this, you know, he was far more empathetic than most people give him credit for. So I'm just painting this contrast of Washington. But anyway, back to the technical, you know, the creation of the very first fighting force, the very first organized force by Continental Congress was the Marine Corps, because they actually had enough money to pay the wages of these Marines to go steal ships. They couldn't form enough money to pay for they just couldn't create the debt to create the first Navy. Because technically the First Navy was really going to be created, but when they realized how much those two ships would cost, it'd be just cheaper to pay for the labor of these, you know, these ruffians that were going to get on the ship and steal the ships. So, anywho, because there's always these challenges. When it comes down to the academic, the authority of what Congress could have done, the reality is the only reason the Army has its precedence in its setting of being the first formed had everything to do with politics and political correctness than it did the facts. And so I'm probably providing information that's not meant, I wouldn't expect it to be warmly received, but if you really look into the facts of whether Continental Congress had the authority and power to do what they were doing, it was a miracle that they were able to form the Marine Corps. And it was a miracle that they, you know, were able to go get a few ships to start building the Continental Navy. But as I point out, under the Constitution, Washington and his favoritism towards the Army instead of the Navy was, I think, one of the big downfalls. Because we were still, as you know, had he started with the Navy like he should have, we probably would not have been, the British would not have been able to successfully attack us in 1812. Because that's exactly what happened. They attacked us, and they floated right up the Potomac, and they burned D.C. down. D.C. was destroyed. All of the books, all of the records, it was destroyed at the hands of the British in that War of 1812. And so, you know, that was how important the Navy was to strategically protect us from an invasion by the sea. Because an invasion by land, it's, you know, it's harder to, you know, to sneak up on somebody, because you got to, you know, you're going through Georgia, North, South Carolina. I mean, everybody knows, hey, they're coming from the south, they're coming from the north, or they're coming from the prairies. But anyway, I digress. So going forward, now that we've got the Constitution ratified and we've got the cod fishery bounties, because prior to reading the Constitution, Sean and I went through the cod fishery bounties. That was technically in 92. Now, backing up, we're going to cover the Assumption Act. And so we got about 3 minutes, which isn't enough time to cover what we want to cover with Jefferson's account. So what ended up happening is, as the federal government formed, they had this requirement of actually servicing existing debt. They inherited the debt of the Confederation. And they basically signaled to the world, hey, we're going to honor this debt. Well, so they had to come up with a way of paying the debt. So in 1789, when they were forming, they still had not really addressed the debt. Not that they didn't talk about it. They were coming up with ways of how to do that. Now, I've gone through the records and so forth, and there were efforts in trying to create taxation. As long as, remember, the taxation had to be uniform. So one of the taxes that they wanted to do was imposts, and they were trying to work on that. And why did it take time to get imposts laid out? Just so you understand, Sean, they required the emissaries and this ambassador network to basically present these, if you want to call them treaties or what have you, to each of the states, foreign states that they were dealing with, to let them know, we're going to lay a tax upon the goods coming in, because at this point in time, there were no taxes. But the Constitution granted the federal government the ability to tax. So there was this requirement of letting them know, hey, we're going to start taxing what we're selling, because we know you're taxing our stuff. And so we are going to basically reciprocate in taxing. This goes in hand with what Trump has been doing regarding the tariffs. The whole world has been basically waging economic warfare by taxing and taxing and taxing American goods going into their countries. You can listen to, because I see these in, you know, social media feeds and so forth, where, who's the economist? Milton Friedman is talking about taxation on, you know, imports is a bad thing. No, it's not. He talks about tariffs being a bad thing. No, it's not. It all depends on whether the nations you're dealing with are dealing equally fair with you. If they're taxing our goods, then we cannot, you know, just send them our goods for free, because that it doesn't create a, there's a need for reciprocating, so that we actually have what I would say the credibility as a nation to say, you're going to do that to us, we're going to do it back to you. Does that make sense? Because yeah. What we would want to do is we would really want to have a free exchange of goods. I mean, Milton Friedman's right. That's the best way to go. But
it can't be one way.
Yeah, but you're right. And the world, because the world has gone to bed with socialism, the government needs to come up with a way to pay for the lazy butts that they've socialized. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. Yes, sir. So now we're going to go into break, and then we'll kind of address how socialism has grown and how the need for government to basically pay for, because government has assumed control over our production of goods, over their production of goods worldwide as well as ours. In other words, we don't have a free market. We have a mercantile system, and the governments are involved worldwide. So we'll get into that, and then we'll dive into the Assumption Act. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, which was written in 1776, begged the argument that we needed to have free trade, but we needed also to have some level of government. And that, government is necessary. We got to pay for it, so they got to tax us. But it should all be based on necessity. In other words, that's one of the reasons why it was very common in the Americas for them to say, well, we need to at least have the necessary government to be able to do the things that it needs to do so that it can succeed. And so as we look at the world economy at that point in time, as we broke free from Britain. When we broke free from Britain, we were no longer encumbered with, I'll just call them, requisitions, where the British government said, you have to give us this much in tobacco from the state of Virginia, from the state of, so they were basically levying, who could grow tobacco to where and so forth, where the state was actually the intermediate in basically telling the different farmers, okay, did you grow tobacco? Because if you grew tobacco the previous year, your ground was useless. You couldn't grow tobacco again. So they had to move it to, and you didn't want that to befall you. And what they tried to do is they tried to make sure that each farm or each plantation that grew tobacco had at least enough of their own land to provide for themselves. In other words, they wouldn't enforce upon all the plantations 100% production. They would make it so that they could get the quantities or what the requisition was from Britain to be met so that the plantations could sustain themselves, because, they're going to make the money. And actually, that was the cash crop, by the way. In other words, Britain wasn't coming with silver. They were coming to actually take the tobacco, and they would give us credit in receiving goods instead of actually giving us silver. They started doing this because they learned a very valuable lesson in China when they started exchanging opium for tea in the 1600s. Did you know this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Because what ended up happening was China basically says, we want you to start paying in silver. And that's when the British, or I should say the West Indies Trading Company, sent gunboats up the Guangzhou and all these different rivers and just, blew up all the inhabitants along the riverside, killing and destroying, and basically saying, you still want us to pay in silver?
And
that's right. And so that's one of the reasons why China became so ruthless as well. Not that China wasn't ruthless. Look at Genghis Khan. When it came down to you do whatever you have to do, that became the necessity, or that became, I should say, the dark side of government and the dark side of humanity. But nevertheless,
how much do you think how much do you think that that mercantile superior mentality the British used on the Chinese had to do with the development of this 5G warfare, we're going to dominate the world mentality that we're dealing with now?
Well, so have you read the article?
That's not an easy answer.
No. So actually, there's a really good book that is very, very old, that has been around a long time, that has become the standard. As a matter of fact, this book is a common read for every CEO in the world, and most all presidents, almost all leaders of the world have all read this one book. It's called The Art of War by Sun Tzu.
Yes, sir.
And we're talking about a book that's thousands of years old, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Well, things haven't changed much since chapter 3.
Well, so when you look at what The Art of War does, The Art of War basically says you must acquire full domination. I mean, the goal is, you know, to have full control. That's it. In other words, you know, you're not to be, you know, sharing. You have to get to, and you have to use every advantage you possibly can come up with, and it gives you ways of creating those advantages. And so, I mean, The Art of War kind of leads, and is that there's other books, other really dark books that actually lead in the manipulation process and all of those types of things. Sun Tzu and The Art of War was really all about strategic military tactics. Now, there are other books that are even far worse and darker about, you know, the controlling of people by, you know, basically debasing them. And the Talmud is one of those books. There are other books out there. And these books are pretty dark and evil. And, you know, when we see books like Mein Kampf or the Manifest, you know, the Communist Manifesto, those types of documents, those are nothing compared to these other dark documents and other dark books, because they give you what is palatable to society. In other words, when the Communist Manifesto came out, they believed that it was not necessarily going to be warmly embraced, but society was far enough along to hear that state needed to control the production of children and the education and nurturing of society from, you know, by decimating the family and taking control of the family unit. That's in Mark Engels and Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto. So yeah. It gives you a glimpse of the darkness, but it doesn't actually talk about how really evil it is. As a matter of fact, the Fabian Society, when they came to America, they were practicing such, you know, debased evil practices of pedophilia and all sorts of really just evil sexual practices. Really dark stuff that had everybody understood that, you know, sex is like an ordinance to evil. These are acts that you have to do that are, you know, in society's eyes, they're just reprehensible. But you have to do them because now they have that control over you. You have to have this mutual control over each other. In other words, if you wander, they've got the pictures of you. You've got the pictures of them. This is this mutual destruction assured kind of thing. Does that make sense? That's how dark and evil, you know, when we look at how things are today. You probably heard of all these, and every time I go down this path, or usually the listeners, they hear this, oh, they love this type of stuff. When we talk about baked babies and that type of stuff, where, you know, the mother did not produce a child with the father. They produced a child with a Satanist leader or what have you. That was done during a very specific moon event and so forth. You know, these are things that they're just hard for people to fathom. How, you know, how dark and evil they are. And, oh, come on, this is just too hard to believe. Like the Bohemian Grove or the eating of babies. These types of things are just, you know, they're rejected because who could be that evil? We can't fathom these types of levels of debasement. So, that all being said, I believe that we're at a point where, you know, it's just a matter of layers of darkness that we're getting closer and closer to those darker layers. We are.
Inventing new forms of evil.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, look at what we've normalized. We've normalized, you know, these different forms of sexuality and other things. Like human organ harvesting. I mean, that's a level of darkness that no society ever had, where they've got people living in captivity to basically steal their lives. Their only purpose is to maintain their organs so they can harvest them. Anyway, it's pretty evil stuff. But anyway, let's get into this whole desire to actually start.
Might even be princes.
Yes. So what I want to do is I want to actually get into Jefferson talking about this deal, because Hamilton was convinced, and he convinced Jefferson that they needed to basically assume the debt, because the northeastern states, or the New England states, were overwhelmed. They couldn't pay their debt. They didn't have the money that the southern states and slave states had. Everybody was just trying to get by up there. You know, it was kind of like your rural areas. They didn't have the big production by slavery. And so this is where labor got exploited up in Massachusetts and the New England states. And that's why the factories came in and exploited people. I mean, you know, we do what we have to do to get by. Bottom line, though, is Hamilton was trying to make a deal with Congress, and Madison was shutting him down. Hamilton basically created a scene of drama. He waited for Jefferson to come along in whatever building it was when they were. This had to be, because it was in 1790, they were in New York still. So whatever the building they were in, when Jefferson came along and saw, you know, Hamilton just sitting there. And this is the story that is told by Thomas Jefferson. So without any further ado, I'll let you go ahead and read Jefferson's account of the bargain on the assumption and residence bill, the resident being, where is the seat of the District of Columbia going to be? Is it going to be down on the Potomac? Is it going to be up in New York? And Philadelphia or Pennsylvania felt that they would be the seat of government, that it would come, that they would give up that because it would be, make it close to them. See, every state wanted to have the federal government close to them because, you know, the closer you are to the kitchen, the less, you know, less you starve, right? So everybody wanted to be close to the federal government. But the logic is, because you've got 13 states and they're pretty well spread out along the eastern seaboard, you kind of want to put it somewhere central so that everybody feels like it's not a disadvantage to them, at least to get everybody to buy off on it. So let's go ahead and pick up Jefferson. Jefferson's telling this story in 1790. Go ahead.
The assumption of the state debts in 1790 was a supplementary measure in Hamilton's fiscal system. When attempted in the House of Representatives, it failed. This threw Hamilton himself and a number of members into deep dismay. Going to the president's one day, I met Hamilton as I approached the door. His look was somber, haggard, and dejected beyond description. Even his dress, uncouth and neglected. He asked to speak with me. We stood in the street near the door. He opened the subject of the assumption of the state debts, the necessity of it in the general fiscal arrangement, and its indispensable necessity towards the preservation of the Union, and particularly of the New England states, who had made great expenditures during the war on expeditions which, though of their own undertaking, were for the common cause. that they considered the assumption of these by the Union so just and its denial so palpably injurious that they would make it a sin qua non of a continuance of the Union.
Yeah, so sine qua non is basically like sine die, you know, shutting down your session. But sine qua non is the absolutely scuttling, or basically the dismissal.
Yeah, completely
ending the government, not just shutting down the session. So go ahead.
That as to his own part, if he had not credit enough to carry such a measure as that, he could be of no use and was determined to resign. He observed at the same time that though our particular business laid in separate departments, yet the administration and its success was a common concern, and that we should make common cause in supporting one another. He added his wish that I would interest my friends from the South, who were those most opposed to it. I answered that I had been so long absent from my country that I had lost a familiarity with its affairs, and being but lately returned, had not yet gotten into the train of them. That the fiscal system being out of my department, I had not yet undertaken to consider and understand it. That the assumption had struck me in an unfavorable light, but still, not having considered it sufficiently, I had not concerned in it, but that I would revolve what he had urged in my mind. It was a real fact that the eastern and southern members, South Carolina, however, was with the former, had gotten into the most extreme ill humor with one another. This broke out in every question with the most alarming heat. The bitterest animosity seemed to be engendered, and though they met every day, little or nothing could be done for mutual distrust and antipathy. On considering the situation of things, I thought the first steps towards some conciliation of views would be to bring Mr. Madison and Colonel Hamilton to a friendly discussion of the subject. I immediately wrote to each to come and dine with me the next day, mentioning that we should be alone, that the object was to find some temperament for the present fever, and that I was persuaded that men of sound heads and honest views needed nothing more than explanation and mutual understanding to enable them to unite in some measures which might enable us to get along. They came. I opened the subject to them, acknowledged that my situation had not permitted me to understand it sufficiently, but encouraged them to consider the thing together. They did so. It ended in Mr. Madison's acquiescence in a proposition that the question should be again brought before the House by way of amendment from the Senate, that though he would not vote for it, nor entirely withdraw his opposition, yet he should not be strenuous, but leave it to its fate. It was observed, I forget by which of them, that as the pill would be a bitter one in the southern states, something should be done to soothe them, that the removal of the seat of government to the Potomac was a just measure and would probably be a popular one with them, and would be a proper one to follow the assumption. It was agreed to speak to Mr. White and Mr. Lee, whose districts lay on the Potomac, and to refer to them to consider how far the interests of their particular districts might be a sufficient inducement to them to yield to the assumption. This was done. Lee came into it without hesitation. Mr. White had some qualms, but finally agreed. The measure came down by way of amendment from the Senate and was finally carried by the change of White's and Lee's vote. But the removal to Potomac could not be carried unless Pennsylvania could be engaged in it. This Hamilton took on himself, and chiefly, as I understood through the agency of Robert Morris, obtained the vote of that state on agreeing to an intermediate residence at Philadelphia. This is the real history of the assumption, about which many erroneous conjectures have been published. It was unjust, in itself oppressive to the states, and was acquiesced in merely from a fear of disunion, while our government was still in its most infant state, and enabled Hamilton so to strengthen himself by corrupt services to many that he could afterwards carry his bank scheme and every measure he proposed in defiance of all opposition. In fact, it was the principal ground whereon was reared up that speculating phalanx in and out of Congress, which has since been able to give laws and to change the political complexion of the government of the United States.
Okay, yeah. So in the very end there, he really points out how Hamilton was enabled to do really bad things moving forward because he was the guy that got the first bad deal done. And when all of a sudden he can actually, you know, compromise people, well, there's something in this for you. There's something in this for you, too. You know, making sure that there's enough to go around so that he can get enough votes. That is where the shift and the paradigm started, and it became so bad that by 1778, they were literally making, they were doing things that were just unacceptable, to where Thomas Jefferson and Madison had to stand up and do, you know, hey, this is it. We're done. So he this is him telling, you know, I think a decent job in objectively telling the story. Now, on the details, because I only go through this maybe once a year, and to remember that this was outside instead of in a big building up in New York. Nevertheless, what ended up happening was they only did 2 years up in New York, and then the rest of the remaining years were done in Philadelphia until the D.C. was inhabitable by both Congress, the President, the Supreme Court, and so forth. So I believe Thomas Jefferson was the first president. I think John Adams was the first president in the White House, but it wasn't complete. I believe the White House was complete in Jefferson's presidency, which was the beginning of 1801. So that's how, you know, they had 10 years in Philadelphia to get the drippings from, you know, the spending of money of, you know, these delegates renting the spaces because they were coming in and paying money. You know, New York had a 2-year benefit of that, and then Philadelphia had a 2-year benefit. I mean, everybody wants government to come along and have their convention right there because they're paying for stuff. You know, it buoys up your business. A lot of people, you know, shoot, it's government. People are going to come there. People want to hear what you're doing. So it becomes the center. And so choosing the way they spelled Potomac, P-A-T-O-W, Patow or Pato, you know, that's kind of interesting the way they spelled it out back then. But
isn't that from the Indians?
Whether they changed the name or whether the spelling changed more accurately,
because I think they probably just transliterated it into English.
You know, so Jefferson in his presidency created He basically created the written language of many tribes, 20 some odd tribes. Gave them their own alphabet and, you know, how they could, you know, spell out the words that they use and so forth. I mean, because he was a subject matter expert on language. So he was able to help them do that. And I think in some ways they may have been able to be more correct, because I don't think that they wanted to change the true meaning of how to spell the Potomac. But at that point in time, you know, it was still a mystery, but they were still maintaining, the Indian names, because that's what everybody called it. Well, what do you call this? So we call this the Potomac. Oh, so everybody started calling it the Potomac. Anyway, right, wrong, or indifferent. I
like the old spelling better. It's the phonetic gives you more idea of what it's called.
Yeah. Okay, so as we go down the path of, you know, spelling, whatever, that's fine. But what we wanted to do was basically lay out, if you can see, this was heading quickly into a point where the nation was going to dissolve, right? Hamilton and Jefferson Jefferson was seeing this. He was actually seeing this disdain and so forth. And, you know, it was Hamilton that brought everybody together. And because Hamilton was bestowed the privilege of being the corrupter, he was the go-to guy in making deals happen moving forward. Does that make sense? So when we get into the Bank Act and everything else, then we can kind of actually start peeling the onion. But what we want to do in our next show, actually, what we're going to do, because we've just got barely 2 minutes, what we want to do in the next show is, because we'll have Tammy with us, we want to kind of do a round robin on what did we learn now that we finished the Constitution. What did you learn? What did I learn? What, and folks, if there's any benefit or if there's something that we could have covered better, then just let us know. But what we want to do is, you know, close out on the Constitution with, you know, any comments and, you know, observations. So we'll do that when we have Tammy in the next show tomorrow. But what we'll also do is we will cover the actual assumption bill so that everybody can see how Hamilton made it. He played it so that every state was going to get a benefit. And so in some ways, the states that had the greatest benefit were the states that actually paid their debt. And so they, because, you know, the states that couldn't pay their debt, they just needed that help. But it was unfair to the states that paid their debt. So we're going to go through how Hamilton made everybody happy in the Assumption Act. And on top of, you know, by using the seat of government. I mean, he started manipulating lots of things in motion already. Some things were literally up there for grabs, like the seat of government. Where was that going to go? So you've heard me say this, that the Constitution gives no room for politics. What is politics? It's the art of compromise. What can Congress compromise on? Well, in the Constitution, they had to compromise on the seat of government. So they had to play politics on where that seat would be and what state would accede to the, you know, giving up the land. They don't have the ability to compromise or have politics on a bank. So we're going to cover a lot of these different things where they used compromise to do something where they didn't have the ability to do it. And so going through these debates is what's really critical, because we're going to go through in the banking debate where Madison is going to point to the ratification debates. And guess what? Hamilton doesn't say anything about the Federalist Papers. He doesn't bring up the Federalist Papers. He doesn't say, well, let's look at the Federalist Papers. And he says nothing about the ratification debates. He tries to sell principles that don't exist. He tries to convince people that there are these principles of implied powers that come with the Constitution. So thank you for joining us today, Sean. And we'll see you tomorrow. We'll see you tomorrow with Tammy. But nonetheless, I appreciate your time and your patience in going through all of this stuff with us.
Well, I'm learning so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Awesome. Great. And again, folks, there's, you know, there's a lot of things we can go through, but what's really most important are going through the things that actually identify how things went wrong and what we need to do moving forward to avoid these exact same problems. So moving forward, we'll be a lot smarter. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract.
and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.